Chapter 29. Cherchez la mer. The quintuplets who lived in the new Dion house were a family unto their own. Though there were two parents and five other siblings inside, the bond they had formed during the first 9 years of their life in the Defoe nursery was not easily broken. Some of the girls attempted to make friends with their siblings, but were often met with venomous attacks. Many of their meals were shared alone in the basement with each other, rather than deal with the discord of a full family table. Their parents fought incessantly, often deflecting their anger and frustrations directly towards Marie, Yvonne, Cecile, Annette, and Emily. Elzear Dion ruled the roost with an iron fist and seemed intent on breaking the girls' will, and if not their will, at least their happiness. With hours of chores and menial labor, other siblings appeared unencumbered by. One day, as she and the girls left for a walk to pick up some fruit, she stopped and reprimanded Marie directly, saying, "Not you. It's not worth it to take you, with your cross eyes. You won't see the strawberries. You'll step on them." Emily bore it the worst, as her seizures had been getting more frequent and were particularly acute after having been berated by her mother. Forbidden to leave the gates that surrounded their property and continually harassed within by their siblings and parents, the girls dreamed of either a return to the idyllic life they had once known in the nursery, or an escape to a boarding school where they might stay for weeks at a time without being harassed by their family. While the harsh parenting styles of that era might be considered child abuse today, attitudes had begun to change. Elzear Dion represented the old way of parenting, but advances in the field of mental disorders would begin to frown upon her forbidding technique. In the wake of pioneers like Sigmund Freud and his contemporaries, theories explaining the underpinnings of the human psyche exploded. With hypotheses which were unfalsifiable, there was seemingly no limit to how far or outlandish the explanations for mental illness could become. Heredity did not appear to have played a part in the origin of autism, but the emerging field of psychoanalysis began to offer another intriguing option, one that many physicians would latch onto. As elaborate constructs regarding the architecture of the human mind increased, so too did their belief in its fragility. The harsh parenting styles of old were thought to be too dangerous. Reading through their work, one gets the sense children began to be treated as delicate creatures, overwhelmed by a world of incomprehensible dangers, their eggshell psychoses liable to break in half with the tiniest admonishment. As more children began to appear with the traits of autism and with hereditary factors out of the question, an inevitable connection was drawn. If it wasn't the genetic attributes of the parents themselves that was causing autism, perhaps it was their behavior, their attitude, and interactions with their children that had caused them to act so strangely. As one famous purveyor of this school of thought put it, quote, "It may become clear to the reader how the parents' mishandling brought about the disturbances we must now try to rectify," end quote. Autistic phenomena which previously mystified felt easily explained within the conjured modalities of the psychology of the day. Donald Triplett's obsession with sorting old Time magazines had originally been declared nonsense, but with the lens Freud had provided Connor's contemporaries, Donald could be viewed simply as a child obsessed with the passing of literally time itself. It was suggested that perhaps children were responding to the pressure of demanding parents. They couldn't handle what was being asked of them and responded in the only way they knew how. They shut everyone off. They withdrew into their own world. Some habits remained, such as the rigid adherence to schedule and routine, but these children were deeply disturbed by the inappropriate actions of their parents, namely their mothers. The old way of parenting emphasized strict routine. Under new guidelines, this was seen as far too rigid, and as a result, mothers and fathers who enforced the old way of parenting would inevitably see this behavior manifested in the autistic child's maniacal preference for order and pattern. Case histories, even into the late 1960s, can be observed struggling to find meaning in the relationships between parents and the child. Did the father's early departure for military deployment affect the child's willingness to bond with his parents? Was the mother's lack of conviction about her being a fit parent reflected in the way she refused the breast for her daughter? On and on these psychological what-ifs rambled, trying to come up with any reason why a child with no hereditary predisposition might suddenly take a turn months after developing normally. The fact that most children with autism had been born and developed typically, only to later display the regression of the disorder, only served to bolster physicians' claims. The children were clearly fine for the first year or two of their life. Most hadn't suffered any traumatic injury or infection, so what else might explain this sudden change in behavior besides a traumatic, emotional capitulation to the rigors of living beneath an iron-fisted mother who struggled to love them? Chercher la mère became popular, a phrase Dr. Connor initially resisted, but with all his peers in agreement, he eventually succumbed. Find the mother, the English translation went, and you will understand the child. While these stories may come across as metaphorical examples of a fringe movement, they were decidedly mainstream. Newspaper articles were penned, books were written. It was the parents' fault, a concept so readily accepted that clinical therapies were developed to recover a child from autism. Intense sessions where the child was nowhere to be found. It was the mother who attended. Her deficient parenting was the cause of her child's autistic behavior, and only through wholehearted attempts at changing her ways would her affected son or daughter have any hope of restoration. Across the country, support groups began to form, clusters of mothers who had likely done precisely what their doctors had told them to do and were now meeting in shame because they believed their inability to love their son or daughter had triggered their child's autism. Needless to say, this approach did not work. Improvements that children like Donald had experienced were likely unaffected by the most intense efforts these mothers and their doctors could muster. They were told their children were autistic because they did not love them enough, and despite weeks, sometimes months, of concentrated effort, their children did not return, an obvious sign their love was insufficient. The emotional toll on parents, already beset with grief by children who would not even look at them, was incalculable.